All right. So we got, I think that was a very appropriate section for us to read today as we are dealing with the first day of unleavened bread. And I think this is really important. Of course, Yeshua couldn't tell them this on the first day because he was already in the grave. But this is, I think, the important thing. We know that this was his prayer for his disciples as they were waiting for the resurrection. See, we don't have that wait. We're waiting for the return. We're waiting for the second coming. We're waiting for his return. We're not waiting for that, you know, resurrection that he had 3 days later. They were just dealing with him having just been killed. We already know that he rises. Now we're waiting for the return. And we have to go through the challenges of that weight and that mindset. All right, so this is what we call the afterburn. So if you have any comments or questions, you know, you can ask them now. And Manny will help write them down and make note of them back there on the desk. Being assisted by, looks like, Mr. David Hayes, or he's just standing there keeping him company either way. Okay, so I think it's really important that we take some time during the days of unleavened bread here, especially at the beginning, to recognize that there was a short window of time. It was only a few days where they were, I would say, lost is not probably a wrong word to use, but they were lost in a certain way because he was gone. They had been with him for that journey, and now he was gone. They watched him die. And now they're dealing with that loss. And they don't get any, you know, of the console, you know, they're not being, what's the word I'm looking for? They're not being comforted. They're not getting any consolation because he doesn't rise for 3 days and three nights. And so I think that it's important that we can think about how that must have been for them. And, you know, because some of us wish, like, well, can Yeshua just come tomorrow? That would be really nice because I'm suffering right now. Well, their suffering, you know, was for a couple of days, but then, of course, after that, there was a lot of, you know, interesting things that came about after the word got around about the resurrection. And then you have guys like Sheol going around trying to kill them all, and this was a problem. We had at least arresting them and bringing them in. And so think about that as part of the journey, because remember, we're walking through a rehearsal of the story and of the plan. And the beginning of the plan is the deliverance. Remember, we got the four cups, Exodus 6, 6, and 7. Okay, so first comes the deliverance. He's got to deliver us out of our bondages. Okay, and so that's really important. We have the deliverance out. And we're now being in that process where he's delivering us out of all kinds of ignorance. He's delivering us out of all kinds of foolish behavior patterns, thinking patterns, emotion patterns, as we try to now align ourselves with his thinking patterns, behavior patterns, emotion patterns, etc. That's the transforming. That's to be more and more Yeshua-like. And so that's because we know that Yeshua was very much father-like. And so that's the image that we have to, that's our target, that's what we're aiming at as we go through this process. So it's an important thing as we go through this that we're looking forward, knowing that that's what they went through as we're going through these things as well. All right? Now, something else did come up, and I didn't get to explain it, and maybe the person who asked this question will watch this so I can kind of answer it. Okay, the question had to do with the understanding that putting blood on the doorposts is sin. I don't think I ever taught it as being sin. I just said that it was only done once and that we shouldn't be doing that now. It would be wrong, though, to do the thing that gets you the blood. Okay, the sacrificing of the lamb to get the blood is something that was only to be done a certain way in a certain place, and we don't have those things right now. You need Levites, and you need the priesthood, and you need the temple, and we have none of those. And so bear in mind that when you read Scripture, you will find they only did it one time. It was for a very specific purpose, and that was because that was the 10th plague. It was to prevent them from dying during the 10th plague. And so they didn't have any worry about the 10th plague ever but that once. That one night is the one time that 10th plague came through. And so, no, there's no verse telling you it's sin to go and do that. I just don't know why you would. It's going to stain the doorpost and lintel of your house. It's going to smell awful. And it's going to serve no purpose whatsoever. there's nothing constructive, positive, or beneficial that it will do for you. But just recognize, to get the blood, you have to kill the animal. And to kill the animal, now you're going to be breaking a commandment for that, because you are not to just go ahead and do these things. And this is part of the critical piece. All right? Look, there are people that miss the point on a bunch of these things. I said I was going to talk about this. I'll talk about it now. The Passover has a lot of traditions linked to it. I've heard a lot of people out there embracing those traditions. I've seen a lot of people out there eviscerating those traditions and just absolutely having issue with every possible piece of the traditions. Let's be clear, right? Yeshua says he's going to want you to speak without figures of speech, but clear. That's the way he was going to speak, so I'm going to try and be clear. There is absolutely only two things that could be wrong with tradition, okay? One is if it somehow goes against or interferes with Torah. If there's actually a Torah command against it, or it is used as an excuse or a way to cause you to break a Torah command. The second is if you elevate the tradition to being a Torah command, equal to as if it's Torah. Now Paul tells them, keep the traditions I've taught you. He calls them traditions. He said, keep the traditions I've taught you. So there's nothing wrong with that. There are many traditions that Yeshua runs up against that he never scolds them that the traditions are wrong. They're washing their hands, okay? And they're doing it a certain way. Actually, I was just going to say it again. They were supposed to be washing their hands, at least the way the Pharisees and Sadducees would have thought, but they didn't do this ritual. In Mark chapter 7, we read about this, but it doesn't say where he says, well, it's wrong to do this hand washing thing. He just says, it's a tradition. Why are you bothering my disciples about it? So what? They didn't do it. It's a tradition. He says, you guys, however, have a bigger problem. You have traditions that you're using to break Torah. And many traditions you have that break Torah, he says, or give people permission to break Torah. Like, instead of taking care of your parents, saying the funds that I was going to use, the money I was going to use to take care of my parents, I gave it to the temple, so now I don't have to take care of my parents. So, we do not involve ourselves with some of the traditions of Passover that I think are problematic. We don't have an egg, okay, which is a fertility and sort of thing that's connected to all kinds of paganism. We don't do the egg. And traditionally, there's a thing called a Seder plate. We don't do a Seder plate, but people have do them. If you did this last night, I'm not attacking you. Don't feel guilty. You don't need to repent and everything else. I'm just giving you some instruction. And next year, I will do all of this before Passover. Okay? But on the plate, often will be a shank bone to represent the lamb. And I've heard people say that this is breaking Torah because it's a bone that has been broken, and Yeshua is supposed to be the lamb and not a bone that's broken and all this other stuff. Look, everything about the Seder is imagery to help with the story and to trigger our memory and our thoughts. We are not literally doing the performing of the Passover. I thought I made that really clear in the Passover Q&A. You know, part one, we're not literally doing, there's two parts to the Passover. Let's be really clear. You perform it, we don't do that now. But you perform it on the 14th between the evenings, we mean the 14th in the afternoon before the 15th. Okay? Between the evenings, simply meant in the afternoon. Okay, so you kill the animal and you go ahead and you cook it and you roast it to do everything it says in Exodus to do when there was a temple to do it at, to go and slaughter the animal and bring it and all these other things. Now, then there's the eating of the Passover. That happens as soon as the meal was done. So by the way, you did not have to wait till sundown to eat your meal. The Passover meal does not have a timing. It's simply when the meal would be done after you would have taken the animal back after slaughtering it, prepare it, roast it, cook it, then you can eat it. Now, likely that would be after sundown by the time that all got going, which is why you had to have unleavened bread at the meal, because it was now going to be the first day of unleavened bread. And so you would have your leaven dealt with, and you only had unleavened bread at the meal. So bear in mind that those... So do you need to have lamb at your meal? No. It says in the instruction that you would have the lamb and the bitter herb, etc., but you would have to get that lamb a certain way. So is it wrong to do the lamb? Jews don't do the lamb today. Why? Because they don't have the temple to do it properly. Does that make it wrong? No. Do you have to have the lamb? No. It's something we do as tradition to remind us of what the instruction is if we were to be doing the instruction. Because the instruction isn't to have lamb. The instruction is to take the lamb, select it out, hold it for a couple of days, bring it over, have it slaughtered. I mean, there's a lot to do with the lamb. It's not just about having lamb at your meal, so that we're clear. And we had lamb at our meal. And we, for Dave, I'll just say, we went to the Mexi-Greek and got the really good stuff. So we had good lamb at our meal, because that store was open for takeout. Okay, but we did not have the shank bone. But there are those that would say, well, the shank bone is offensive because it says that not a bone should be broken. Okay, there's no place that says not a bone shall be broken in the when it talks about the Passover. That's a different verse in Isaiah that talks about not a bone would be broken. Okay, so we have different places to talk about that. And Yeshua not having a bone broken. Now, this Passover lamb and the whole meal has all these traditions. So some people do a matzah ball soup. There's no place in Scripture that says to do a matzah ball soup. Some people have, you know, haroset. Haroset is a sweet apple honey, I mean apple and cinnamon and walnut thing and honey also. Okay, you mix that up. Now, people can say, oh, well, there's traditions back from Rome and the Greeks, and they did these certain things, and they had them in their different symposiums and their meals and whatever. Look, the Jews have been doing it because it looks like the stuff you make bricks out of. Okay, we're using memory triggers for the children and for each other. We have these things that help connect us to some of the elements. Okay, we have bitter herb, well, because he tells us to in the meal instruction in Exodus, but also because it reminds us that their lives were embittered. Okay, they had bitter and harsh lives in the work that they did. There's all kinds of symbology. I explain this in the Haggadah. But recognize that these things, just because other cultures have done things like this and other cultures have put things together, doesn't make that it completely wrong to be using these kind of triggers, etc. They are traditions, though. And so we don't have all of the traditions that, say, the Jewish community does. We've chosen to avoid some of them because we have our reasons to just decide we don't want to do them. But they're traditions, so we don't break anything by not doing them. And if you didn't do all of the things that we did, you're not breaking any. There's no place that says you have to make a Hillel sandwich. It's just something that we chose to do by tradition to bring the elements together that we have at the meal. This is important. Okay? Like, it's a very important tradition that we have a good kugel at my meal because I love a good noodle kugel. And so Brianna made a fabulous one last night. It was great. But that's just a tradition. But understand as we go through these things that this is important that you understand that. I'll give you another example. Some of you, and I'm not picking on you, I think this was great, showed fabulous pictures of the fancy, beautiful dinners that you put together last night. Okay, so the only two times that I see this in Scripture, they're girding their loins and have sandals on and they're ready to leave, or they're having it in right before Yeshua, you know, right after Yeshua dies. You know, I'm not having a big fancy right after Yeshua dies. And then, so how are they, you know, doing? Are they all dressing up fancy? And I'm not saying it's wrong to do. I'm just simply saying is we now have developed these traditions to make it very formal. Well, did it have to be very formal? It was very informal in the beginning. They were ready to exit Egypt. They were eating in a hurry. There was no chance to make it all formal. So keep doing it formal if you do. Just recognize that if somebody else doesn't, It's all by tradition. It's your interpretation, what you want to do. People dressed very formally when I did this back in Worldwide Church of God many years ago, and they had their tradition that nobody speaks even. And actually, they weren't even doing Passover anyway because they did it, in my opinion, the wrong day. They did it the night before. They did it the night of the Last Supper. Okay? And so they were doing that. But the point is, they had a tradition of how everybody walked in. You didn't say anything. Everybody was quiet and, you know. Is it wrong? No, it's a tradition, just as long as people understand. And so this is important. I'll try to do more of this and do a little more of a Q&A next time before Passover. And we'll have like a week or two before where people can, we'll do a little live thing and we'll let you guys ask questions and we'll kind of cover all that. Because people are all trying to figure out, well, what do we need to do? It's all tradition at this point. We're not actually doing this thing the way you're supposed to do it. We're not in the land with the lamb, with the temple, with everything else. So we're doing what we can to memorialize, to commemorate. Does that make sense to everybody? Are we kind of finally getting this? All right? Because some of you may look at some of these pictures and be like, oh, wow, I didn't know we needed to be that fancy. Well, because you don't. My wife just made a long face because she likes being fancy. But you can. And we did. We dressed up. Okay? But You don't have to. I'm just saying, don't feel any pressure or any guilt or any this or remorse that somehow you didn't do it right because you see some other people what they did. And then you see people, if you're brand new, with these Seder plates. A Seder plate is simply a plate that has a different spot for the different elements that they believe are part of the evening. So they put a little of each thing in one of these little places, and it's actually written in the Hebrew what goes where. Okay? Maybe it's in the English too, depending on the ones you get. But just try, you know, to explain all that. We don't have all of those things in our Haggadah because those are traditions I don't think belong there. All right? And so it's important that we understand that there's a place for tradition. And like I said, there are people out there that are totally just attacking every element of this from every direction. Okay, this is not like there's zero way to justify running around chasing chocolate eggs from a rabbit. Okay, there's just, that's not the same thing we're talking about here. That's a whole different problem. But that's also why we don't put the egg in with our Passover, because we certainly don't need to link it to anything else. It doesn't bring any element in that's important. Okay? It certainly can be linked to things that are inappropriate, so why bring it in there? All right? Okay. All right, now I think I gave you as much time as you need, so.
A little bit more?
You're just enjoying the stalling.
All right, I've got a few here. UC Renegade, in 16:2, do you think that means those that deny Jesus would be killed because their Elohim is Jesus, even though we proclaim the name Yeshua?
I don't think that it specifically means anything. It could be for lots of reasons, okay? I mean, those of you that understand beware false prophets, that teaching, and you understand the concerns with the name, you know, using Jesus versus using Yeshua, and why it's not just a, you know, a matter of, you know, what? No, yeah, I'm just saying it's not an etymological problem. It's not just about, you know, changing the language from English from another language. Right? There's a bigger problem with the name, and if you listen to the teaching, I explain it. But if you stop, if you bring that up, you might get thrown out for that, I suppose. I don't know anybody that ever has. But the people, more is about the fact that you're no longer doing Christmas and Easter, and now you're eating differently, and you're talking to people about keeping Saturday and not Sunday, and how come the church is on Sunday? Because you're stirring up the pot, you'll get thrown out. It's because you can't keep silent, because you're going to be too disturbed by what they're doing to keep quiet, which is why I don't know why people stay. I mean, it's just leave anyway. I mean, I can't tell you how many people, not a lot, but enough over the years that were going to Saturday and Sunday. And I'm like, how do you do that? Oh, well, you know, I'm trying to help. You're not helping anything. I've never, ever found anybody who did that and actually brought anybody out. Okay? It doesn't work. I've seen everybody who tried get booted out and told you no longer welcome. It just doesn't work that way. But you're still thinking like a Christian if you're doing those things. If you're thinking you're going to win souls over, or you're going to win them over somehow, this is completely not your job. Listen to the Father and the Son teaching. The Father draws and the Son draws, and that's it. You don't have a role in this. Your only role is if they draw someone to you, not you going and trying to wake somebody up. Okay, you don't have a role in this. Well, I shouldn't say that. Your role is not the role you think it is. They do all of that. Now, somebody may talk to you who's being drawn out, and they found out you're doing something different. They want to know more about it. So you got to be prepared to give an answer. But you're giving an answer. See, it never says prepare to go over and share information. It says prepare to give an answer. But don't go over there and start poking holes in people's bubbles. Some of you actually had this experience. Some of you were not ready when somebody first approached you with this stuff, and you did not like it. And you handled it very badly, as you expected, because you were not ready to have somebody poke at your bubble. But when he did it, there was no problem. I know there's not all of you have the same story, because some of you, nobody really bothered you, and then he poked your bubble, that was fine. But some of you had people try to poke your bubble years before you were ready, and it was not fun. And you didn't finally get this way because of them poking at you. Although when you finally got this way, you did know somebody you could go talk to if you felt like talking to them after they annoyed you before and poked at you and et cetera. Okay, Manny, what else?
Okay, we have another question from Olivia and Janet Hoffman. Rabbi, in regards to chapter 16, verse 3, how do we handle the experience of being cut off from family dynamics / relationships as we stand in truth? How do we reshape family relations when we are now so different?
Look, it all comes down to respect. All relationships are about respect, okay? If they can maintain respect in your relationship, you can maintain your relationship with them. As soon as they push the envelope consistently in a disrespectful way, that's when you say, I'm sorry, but we may not be able to have the relationship that we used to have because you're showing an inability to be respectful. Now, that means you have to be respectful, too. You cannot call them, you know, pagans and sinners and idolaters and everything because of whatever you think they're doing that's wrong. You have to be respectful. All relationships are based on respect. Okay, you cannot have a relationship where there's no respect. So your relationship with your family members is going to change. It may not be as close as it was before when everybody was, you know what, you have the same thing there that is in John 17. Before, there was you and them and they and you were all doing the same things. Well, now you're not. Now you are set apart from them. So the relationship by definition has to change somewhat. But you can still have relationships with your family members, your parents, your children, your sisters, your brothers, friends, etc., provided they are willing to maintain it while recognizing that you are different, so there has to be a respect for the individual. Look, say to them, I have no problem with you walking out your own salvation if you're in trouble, but you need to respect mine. I will not impose on you. Don't impose on me. Then we'll be fine. Perfect example. You have children and you have parents that watch your children occasionally. And when you drop them off with your parents right away are feeding them stuff they shouldn't feed them. And you say to them, you need to stop doing that. I really don't want them having that because this is my beliefs and I want you to honor that. And they keep disrespecting that. Guess what? You're in a good position to say, if you continue to do this, I will not bring them over. You have chosen to change the status of our relationship. Not you, I mean they have chosen by their behavior because they're disrespectful of the relationship. And so if they're going to, if you leave them over there, not respect, and by the way, that could be anything. They could be showing them movies you don't want. They could be using language you don't want. They could be anything. I mean, you know, you have to, now the same thing with your friends and other family members. You know, if they're going to attack or belittle or do whatever it is, you know, to in your relationship, it's all about respect. And by the way, lots of relationships change regardless of this whole stuff. I mean, I've had friendships change over the years before I ever believed any of this stuff. Just because we no longer had the same beliefs and whatever it is, other things, you know. Lots of relationships change over politics. Lots of relationships change over lots of things. Anyway, hopefully that answers the questions. It really has to do with respect. Okay, next.
Okay, next one. Carrie Soveri wants to know, let's see, I think it's 17:3. When Yeshua is praying in 17, he speaks of himself in third person, which is a little confusing, but in 17:3, he says his father is the only true Elohim. Isn't Yeshua also true Elohim?
Okay, so again, you know, we have to understand that there's a hierarchy, okay? And when he's referring to it, he's referring to a positional thing. Bear in mind, for example, when Moses went to Pharaoh, Moses was like Elohim and Aaron was like the priest too. Remember how we kind of had that position? He's giving a positional relationship. He's saying that the Father is the one true top from which there's no higher. He's the one true at the top. That doesn't mean that Yeshua is not of the same makeup. Remember, Yeshua says, my Father is greater than I. And so this is the way that we're talking about it. So one can be like Elohim in the sort of the role they're playing, and the other can be like the high priest or the spokesperson that way, okay? And actually, this is almost like father and son. Moses was supposed to be using his brother Aaron to help speak for him. So then you almost have it be like Moses is Yahweh and Aaron is Moses. Or Moses is the father and Aaron is Yeshua, the spokesperson for Elohim. Okay? And that's why Moses is very much the Mashiach, because Yahweh spoke to Moses directly, and Moses spoke as a Mashiach, speaks for Elohim. Okay?
Okay, next one, Olivier and Janet Hoffman, regarding chapter 17, 11, as well as 21 through 23. When Yeshua prays that we are one, I suppose this includes other groups who walk Torah and embrace Messiah. Is there anything we can do individually to foster this unity?
No, it's only talking about MTOI. Look, it's talking about those that are going to be able to eventually be knit together. Okay, that was Ephesians, and we fell one verse short of that verse, okay, of the body being knit together. This is kind of what MTOI is all about, though. We are looking and seeking those that will be willing to work together in serving the body with the idea that there should be ministries working together and there should be people able to come together. The problem is that we are lacking, how do I want to say this? The problem is we have too many people that are not qualified under Ephesians 4 who are doing Ephesians 4 things. How's that? Okay, too many people walking around claiming to be teachers, prophets, shepherds, etc., evangelists, you know, apostles, who are not qualified. And so the body in general is under inappropriate or wrong leadership that actually doesn't have the qualifications to be doing what they're doing. And so they're following almost like the blind leading the blind. That's where the problem is, okay? So remember, the idea is they're looking for that they may be one as we are one. So they have to be completely in that vertical, which means that there has to be the heads over thousands, the heads over hundreds, but all in that vertical. This is the important part of it. You know, they were supposed to be those that were listening to Kepha or Peter, those that were listening to Shaul, those that were listening to Yaakov, to James, those who were following any of the other apostles were all still supposed to be one, and they all came under Yaakov or James's leadership, but they had their groups that were parts of the body, but they were supposed to still be echad, many members, but yet one. Okay? And so the problem is that we don't have any true, visible, recognizable by others, single authority. Okay? The only place you see that is in the Catholic Church. They're the only group that has a single authority. The Charismatics don't. The Baptists don't. The Methodists don't. I mean, they all have the heads of their little conferences or whatever they have, but they don't have that one voice that guides the whole group. Now, we could say that that's a bad thing because look at how bad it is with the Catholic Church and the Pope. Well, it's only a bad thing when it's done wrong. Scripturally, there is one head, the Father. And then under that is the Son. And that's under the Son. So it basically goes one to one, and then it starts to branch. Because the Son then discipled 12. And then they went out to disciple more. And so hopefully this is, you know, we have to get that whole vertical thing. So, yes, today, I don't know what we can do to foster it. I think that was the rest of the question. What can we do to bring about? Pray that those that are willing to work together will eventually find each other and come together to work together. We are working on, just so you're aware, we're working on trying to, at some point, have a conference of leaders, like a leadership-type conference that's just with the leaders, to promote the need for a modern-day Jerusalem Council. Okay? A modern-day Jerusalem Council. And that would mean that we have to have leaders of ministries to come together and to figure out who should be leading it, how it should work, and how we can bring. Look, we do this in a small degree in MTOI. We have multiple groups that are all part of MTOI. We all have meetings, you know, every month. And we, now in this particular case, I am at the Nasi seat. The Nasi is the head of the group. But the group would have to have one. There's always has to be vertical authority. So multiple heads still have to come under one authority. The heads over 50s came under authority of heads of hundreds or heads of thousands. Everybody was under an authority. Not going to work very easily with all the human beings and all of the egos and the prides and all the fear and the lack of trust. Oh, so you're just wanting everybody to be under you. I don't want anything. Just so we're clear. It's what does he want? I don't know necessarily. You don't know necessarily. I mean, you may have thoughts. I may have thoughts. It's not what I want. It's what he wants. And it's going to come about exactly how he wants it, when he wants it, whether I do it or you do it or anybody else does it or not. He'll find somebody to do it. It's going to happen. And it may not happen until the tribulation may force a little of that. It may not happen until Yeshua comes and establishes it when he returns. We may just stay disjointed, you know, parts of the body. Like I said, we look like we all jumped on the body, jumped on a landmine and exploded everywhere around the world. Okay, we may just stay that way for quite a while. The desire, though, of Yeshua is that we would be ultimately echad, as he says, like he is with his Father. All right, hopefully that makes sense. But pray for, you know, in the future, if we could be worked out, that I'm planning maybe, you know, in the next year, like maybe in the wintertime, to try to promote having some sort of a conference. It would not be open to the public. It would just be for those that are in the fivefold, that at least that, well, we can, that may be willing to come and sit down and talk about how we as a body can work together. Okay? Now, if you know people that you think that should be in that conversation, you can refer them to me so that we can invite them to that kind of a meeting. So maybe you have teachers out there and others that you think are on a fairly sound footing that should be in the discussion. And then we can try to invite them to that conference and to see if it's possible to work towards. And that would be the whole point. John 17 would be the whole point of that conference. You know, can we work together to serve the body? John 17 in conjunction with Ephesians 4. Okay? We're supposed to be here helping the body be perfected into the fullness of the completeness of Messiah. Can we do that individually as a whole bunch of us everywhere in the world, or do we need to do it in a more organized way? Can we be more effective in helping the body? Not effective in saving souls, not effective in winning people over, not effective in, no, effective in working with whoever he draws. Those who he's called out, all right? So we're not looking to be big, we're looking to be effective. And so maybe we can bring people together so that we could be more effective. And not with the everybody's, with the whomsoever he calls out, whomsoever wills. All right, next.
Okay, I'm going to try to figure out this question. I think Robert had a question about something you said earlier. Rabbi, when Yeshua said it is done, meaning that the law wasn't done away with, am I right that it states in Scripture that his laws are forever?
Yes. Look, all he said that was done was what his Father sent him to do. Okay? Look, if I tell my daughter, go clean your room, and she comes back and tells me it's done, I don't necessarily have an expectation that the kitchen was cleaned and that the living room was cleaned and that I have an expectation that the thing I sent her to do was done. Okay? So when she comes to me and tells me it's done, she's telling me that which I sent her to do, she completed it. It has no effect on anything else. It has nothing to do with anything else. And he's correct, the person who asked the question, yes, the laws are forever that say they're forever. I mean, he says these things are forever. Now, bear in mind, forever is not always forever, only from the point of view of there are sometimes parameters necessary to do things so they can be rendered temporarily undoable because you need certain things to be, like you cannot do the Passover slaughtering or the performing of it without the temple and the priesthood. So that law has not been done away with, you just can't do it. You can't stone anybody because for that you need to be, again, in the land with the proper government and the judicial system as set up according to Deuteronomy. So you can't just stone people. See, the things that are not done away with, you just can't do them. All right? Okay, so but all of the law is forever. And if those things were in place where you could do them, you would have to do them. And for all of you that are still suffering from Christian, you know, tendrils that are still in your system that you haven't fully pulled out, don't get a meltdown by the fact that if we ended up with the temple, you'd have to do sacrifice. There will be a temple and sacrifices in the millennium. Just, you're going to have to get, oh no, he didn't. He never did anything to do away with the temple system. That the apostles all kept going for 40 more years. It's a long time. He did not do anything to interfere with the temple service. But yet, you know, a lot of you who still have that little bit of Christian in you, you know, are offended by that. We had a, I think it was Sukkot. We had a Sukkot one year, and somebody was teaching about, I don't even remember what the subject was, but it had to do with sacrifices, and it made the point that there would be sacrifices. And there were several people that got up, because it was a two-part teaching, and didn't come back for the second part because they were so upset. See, that's where the pride and the ego has to be let go. Are you able to receive? That's it. Are you able to receive? In other words, are you able to receive without any limitations? In other words, well, I can receive, but not on this subject. Or I can receive, but not on that issue. Are you able to receive? I had somebody call me the other day and for counsel, and they said, well, you know, something. And then I said, are you arguing? And they were like, no. I said, because if you're going to come for counsel, I don't want to argue with you. You're either going to take the counsel and do Deuteronomy 17 or you're not. Okay, but don't argue with me. That's the structure. Now, you don't have to do what I say. I don't really care. I mean, that's between you and the Father and your own life. But don't argue with the teacher or the counselor you go to. If you're asking for counsel, Deuteronomy tells you, you go and you get counsel. If you're just taking an opinion poll, then don't even call me. But if you are actually wanting counsel, I take that seriously. And I'm going to give you counsel expecting that if you do it, you're going to be receiving or getting the results you were hoping to get. And if you don't, then I know that that would be on me if the counsel was not good. And so, but we don't argue about that stuff. But there's the pride and the ego. So when I mention things like sacrifices, you're like, oh, no, no, no. There's a lot of people that still are struggling with the Last Supper not being Passover. Oh, no, Last Supper was Passover. The Last Supper Passover is a Q&A part two. Okay, it's real simple. Generally speaking, do you eat the animal before or after you kill it? I generally like to eat it after it's been killed. A little easier. And so if Yeshua died when they killed the lambs, then how did he eat the meal the night before? And none of the other Jews had eaten the meal yet. I mean, it says in John that they didn't want to go into Pilate lest they be defiled so that they couldn't keep the Passover. And that's when they were taking Yeshua, shuttling him back and forth, you know, trying to figure out what to do with him. And so they didn't do it. They hadn't had the Passover meal. Okay, that's in, I'll read it to you. It's in John 19:18-28. Okay, so we're almost to that chapter. It's like the next chapter. They led Yeshua from Caiaphas to the palace, and it was early, and they themselves did not go in the palace lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Because if they became unclean, they'd have to wait a month. And nobody wanted to wait a month. You want to do it with everybody else. Okay? And so there's a Torah about if you become unclean. You know, Numbers talks about this so that there's a provision for the second Passover. Now, I will tell you that Caiaphas and his crew had a lot of problems. None of those problems had to do with keeping the right days. So people say, oh, Yeshua was showing that they were doing it on the wrong day and that he did it on the other day. No. Not true, okay? Because even if that was true, then they wouldn't have had to take him down before the holy day because they would have been killed on the holy day. Because if you go back into Exodus, there is no time between the Passover and them leaving. And you go into Numbers 33, and it says, and on that next morning, they left. They woke up, and they left. Now, I know this is a hard thing. When I was going to Worldwide Church of God, they kept it 2 days. They kept that extra day apart. I completely disagree with that. By the way, the very first study Rebbetzin and I did together when we got married and we decided to have a study together, guess what it was on? Trying to figure out that timing of the first day of unleavened bread and Passover and matching it up with the Last Supper. And we were frustrated because it doesn't work. But here's the problem. In our mindset where we were at the time, we were trying to force a round peg into a square hole because we knew that the Last Supper was Passover. And so we were frustrated because it wouldn't work, but we knew it had to work because we were told all our lives that that's what it was. But it doesn't work. You ready for this? Because it doesn't work. That's a profound thought. Because it's wrong. And by the way, that gets me in trouble with some of the bigger teachers out there that get really angry when people teach against that. But it's wrong. It is very clear that Yeshua died when they were slaughtering the lambs. It is very clear that they had not had the Passover yet. It is also very clear that he never corrected them that they were doing it wrong. He corrected zero of their observances. He was there at Sukkot. We see that. He was there for other events, and we see that in his life, that he was there for different events, and he never corrected their Sabbaths and holy days. Not once. So we can assume they were doing it correctly. At least the timing. Maybe not all the rituals. He also said, listen to the authorities when they sit on Moses' seat and they teach you and do what they teach you Moses said to do. He says, don't always do what they do because they do it in a hypocritical way. Hypocritical doesn't mean wrong day. Hypocritical means approach, attitude, and all the other things that have to do with the emotional side of it. It's not the they had a wrong date. It's not about having a wrong time or wrong date. Okay? And so let's just be clear about that, because there's a lot of that going on. Just like all of the people that want to say the lunar Sabbath and the this Sabbath and the that Sabbath, you know what? Unless you can show me that the Jews have done it differently since Yeshua, because they like to go back to Genesis to try to prove their thing. They don't have to go to Genesis. Go to Yeshua. That's 2,000 years ago, not 6,000 years ago. They don't have to go back that far. Did Yeshua keep the Sabbath? Yes. Did the Jews keep it with him? Yes. He said he kept it with his brothers, the Jews, all the time. Did he ever tell them they were doing it wrong? Never. So unless you can show me that somehow he changed it, the Jews changed it in the last 2,000 years, not before that or going on. No, that in the last 2,000 years that they've changed it, you have no case. You have no argument. There's no discussion. End of story. Knock it off. Okay? And I have never found any evidence that the Jewish community has changed it in the last 2,000 years. Matter of fact, we know that they're keeping the same day because all of the Christian writings say, don't do like the Jews. Keeping it on the Saturday, on the Shabbat. You keep it on Sunday. There's your proof right there. And that goes back in their writings all the way back to, guess what? I don't know, like right after Yeshua died. He didn't correct their holy day observances either. Okay? All right, so as long as we understand that and we can keep that going forward. Okay, next question. It's almost 5:00, so I want to end here in a little bit because I've got wonderful leftovers waiting for me.
Next one is from Renaissance. When the temple is back and rebuilt, will we, MTOI, be doing Pesach and all other feasts there?
When these things happen, I'm hoping that whoever's in charge will know what to do and tell us what to do. Okay, if I happen to have any authority, I will trust that he will tell me what to do. At the moment, it's not happening, so I'm not worried about it. We're going to talk about this next week when we get to verses about worry. It says, tomorrow has its own worries. I'm going to worry about today. There is no temple at this point. There's nothing to worry about. I trust, this is the important part, that there will be somebody in authority that will know what we're supposed to do. I know a lot of it's going to depend on who builds it and how it gets started and who's running it and all that. I'm not worried about any of those factors. When it happens, I trust that I will know what to do, meaning I will either be following someone who knows what to do or he will tell me what to do. I'm not worried about it now because it's not an issue. Remember what I've done in past teachings. Don't let too much of the future or the past mess with your today. Okay, right? Today, we don't have a temple. No issue. Don't worry about it. Oh, but the Temple Mount people are... They've said that every year for like forever. Okay, don't worry about that. One day they'll do it, and then we'll figure it out if they actually get it built. Because every year they're telling me, oh, they got the red heifer. They got all of this. They got all of that. I've heard that every year for at least 20-something years. And it still hasn't happened. Okay, so what would I could have worried about it for 20 years for no reason. All right? Just like every year they tell me, and the brilliant conspiracy financial guys telling me that the world economy is just going to collapse. Well, one day it probably will. It hasn't happened yet. They keep saying it's going to, but I would have wasted a lot of energy emotionally worrying about it. You see what I'm saying? Just don't worry about stuff that hasn't happened. When we get there, we just have confidence and let us know what we're supposed to do. All right, next. Oh, wait, one more thing with that. That's even more reason why you need to find yourself an anointed, appointed, a teacher, somebody that you know will know what to do. Okay? So you don't have to worry about that. That's why there's safety and shalom and peace inside the structure. That's why there's no peace in houses that are unstructured. You have a house that lacks structure, and the children and everybody's running around unstructured, there's no peace in that house.
We have another question regarding first fruits. Is first fruits a part of unleavened bread? What scriptures are indicative of disciples observing after Yeshua's death/resurrection?
Okay, so Bikurim, or first fruits, the wave sheaf that's talked about waving before, so to start the Omer count. There's a lot of mix about this from the Messianic side as far as the observance. The Jewish side has no issue with it whatsoever because the Jews know that we're no temple, there's nothing to do. So they don't do anything, okay? We see it as the resurrection of Yeshua, okay? So because people see it, they think we're supposed to do something about it or do something with it. Now, no, there's nothing in Scripture that we need to do, otherwise we'll be adding or taking away. The observance in Leviticus 23 says that when you have the harvest of the land, when you are in the land, it says, and when you get to the land, oh, it's something you do in the land, by the way, then you're going to gather the first fruits of the harvest, you're going to bring it to the priest to wave. Okay, so we're not in the land, and we don't have a priest to wave it. There's nothing to do. Now, we have in the past have had Rabbi Tom do a teaching on this, okay, when we were at a gathering for unleavened bread. We're not going to be able to do that this year. But just so you know, we're not breaking anything by doing nothing. Oh, except I am helping break down some of your emotional attachments to needing to do stuff. Because after all, Christianity celebrated the resurrection, or at least they thought they were, with their Easter and Sunday and all that other stuff, resurrection stuff that they did. There is nothing scripturally that we see even the disciples celebrating the resurrection in any way, shape, or form. We have no evidence of anybody doing any of this. Okay? So, since Bikurim is a harvest-related, land-related, priest-related thing, of which we have none of the above, there's nothing to do. Okay? What we are doing, though, is counting the Omer to Shavuot. We have to use the counting of the timing of that for knowing when Shavuot would be. Okay?
Mike and Pam have a question. Will you comment on the foot washing that many Hebrew roots include as an option?
I forgot to mention that. That was one of those tradition things I forgot to mention. Thank you for bringing that up. No, I'm not going to comment. No, okay, no. You asked me would I comment. Yes, I'll comment. Okay. This is the same answer I just gave, though. We're not adding or taking away. All right? The foot washing, if it became Torah, would be adding to the law. Yeshua didn't add anything to the law. We have to understand what was going on in John, okay? Now, you're not going to understand what's going in John unless you read what's going on in the other Gospels, because John doesn't mention the problem that's being addressed. He just mentions the solution, where the other Gospels don't mention the solution, they mention the problem. And the problem was that at this Last Supper, they were still arguing with each other about who was going to be the greatest in the kingdom. And so Yeshua, having had enough of that nonsense, decides, okay, I need to do something dramatic that will pierce through all of that noise and all that emotional nonsense and get their attention very clearly. The lowest servant in the house washed the feet of people when they came in the house. Because after all, you were wearing sandals or nothing, so you had dirt, it was all over your feet. Okay? And so they would wash your feet. And so he girded himself to look like and to be in the, you know, in the clothing of the lowest servant, and then washed their feet. And he said, look, I need to get the point. I, who am your Messiah, will show you what it means to be the greatest. It means to be the humblest, to be the servant, the greatest servant. Stop. You're approaching this all from pride and ego, he was telling them. You want position. You want authority. You want accolades. You want to be looked at, looked up to. He says, no, I'm going to show you. I'm the one you all look up to. Now you're going to have to look down. I'm going to wash your feet. And so it was a great metaphor, a great lesson, a great humbling for them. Now, bear in mind, I was in Worldwide Church of God. A lot of you were in other churches where they do foot washings. All of you are doing it wrong, pretty much. You want to do it right? It would be me washing the feet of the disciples that I'm making. Now, he did say that they should wash each other's feet to keep them humble, just them, each other's feet. Now, bear in mind, that he never then says, now make that an instruction for everybody. We read about it and we want to imitate it. But we read about it. That's why, so we know. Now, if we were to do it the way they did it at the Last Supper. They didn't do it during Unleavened Bread or Passover, so it would really be something you would do at the Last Supper, which is another reason why I would connect it. You know, Worldwide did their Passover Last Supper sort of foot washing thing all on the same night, which again, to me, brings it into it not being part of Passover. It was never a part of the Passover. You don't see this in Exodus anywhere. But we are also told very clearly not to add or take away. We are not creating new Torah. All right? Now, Yeshua, tongue-in-cheek, says, a new commandment I give to you. Or John tells us, you know, that. And he says, no, it's not really a new commandment. Loving one another, it's like a tongue-in-cheek thing. Here's something new for you. Why don't you try loving each other? Anybody ever use that kind of language with your children or something? Here's a new idea. Why don't you try doing the old thing, what you were told to do? Okay? There isn't anything adding. We don't add. We don't take away. That's mentioned two or three times in the Tanakh very clearly. We do not add or take away. So the foot washing is something that you can do. It's a tradition. Do not elevate it to Torah and do not use it in any way to undermine Torah. There's nothing about it that would undermine Torah. So we're only worried about the second problem. Just don't make it Torah. Do you want to wash each other's feet? Well, you're limited to the people in your house at the moment because of COVID-19. Not a lot of foot washing you can do. Look, I have watched husbands and wives have a tremendous blessing when they've been having strife in their relationship to go ahead and do a foot washing, just the husband and wife, and then see if that doesn't shift your attitudes quite a bit. I mean, that's a big deal. You know, there was strife in my wife's family at one point, and as a part of the restoration, her mother wanted to do some foot washing. And that was when my wife and her mother actually really reconciled before her death. And they got to, and it was a powerful thing for the two of them to do that. And that's a very important memory for my wife, that she got to wash her mother's feet and vice versa. But it was a part of a humbling and restoring a relationship. So it's a nice thing that, but again, is it a Torah command for us to do? No, it's not a Torah command. And I've had people get upset when we've had Passover and all the unleavened bread, and we didn't have it every year. And they're like, well, aren't you going to do the foot washing? I'm like, no. I like that reaction though, by the way. I love doing things that cause people to get, so I can go, see that? Whatever that was, that's what you need to fix. Because they're looking at me like, I need to fix the foot washing. No, that wasn't the problem. Problem is whatever was inside of you that just made you go, and get all upset, you know? Like, we're not doing something. We're breaking a commandment. We're not breaking a commandment. It's like the parent that smacks the kid because they go to put a piece of food in their mouth before praying, before the meal. It doesn't break a commandment, you know, to not pray before you eat. There isn't a commandment to pray before you eat. Is it wrong to do? No, nothing wrong with it. We're told to pray always. So you're praying all the time, so to speak. You're in a vertical connection. But when you make it seem to a child that somehow they've sinned, well, that's different. That's different. When you say to a child, look, in this house we have a tradition. We pray before we eat. I want you to respect that. And then if you want to discipline them because they're not respecting your tradition, that's okay. But just be sure you're not communicating somehow like they made God mad at them for some reason because they didn't pray first. I do this in people's houses all the time, so you're warned. Okay, I'll walk into people's houses, I'll put the food out, and I'll just reach over and grab something and put it in my mouth, and I'll watch the children go, oh, and point at me like, Rabbi ate something, we didn't pray. And I'll look at them like, gotcha. There's some of that tradition as Torah things going on here. A little test move. And so, you know, just recognize that these are the things that we're dealing with. Okay, so as far as the foot washing, you're welcome to do it. It would have been done before Passover, if you want to do it the way they did it. But you could do it any time of year. It's a great humbling experience. Now, here's another thing that people who do it wrong, in my opinion. All right? When we did this in Worldwide Church of God, we just randomly were handed random people to wash their feet. You didn't know the person half the time, because this is back when we were in churches, 900,000 people, whatever. I wouldn't even know the person very well. I mean, I may recognize their face, but I didn't know them. That, you know, they just put you in lines, walk you through, and then randomly match you up with somebody to wash their feet, and then they would wash yours. They were washing each other's feet. They were brothers. Not only, you know, metaphorically, but some of them literally were brothers, but they knew each other very well. There was an intimacy there. And so the purpose of the washing of the feet was to overcome an ego and strife inside of their. So using it to help handle strife is a good thing. pride and ego. That's why I think husbands and wives can really benefit from that. Doing a little foot washing thing when they're trying to finally get through a strife problem. Because you know what? To go, you're mad at somebody, you're having these issues, and you go and have to wash their feet. And then and even more, they're going to wash yours. Wow. Okay? But a lot of places do it. You're really not doing it just with people that you have an intimacy with. The disciples were told to wash each other's feet. They knew each other really well. They lived with each other for years. So this was a big deal. All right, so hopefully that answered that question. But it's a good question. Sorry, I'll make sure I covered that next time.
Okay. I think we have some new people online. They're a little confused with this question. So they'd like to know, if all were covered by the blood when they left Egypt, how come he allowed the unconverted to go with them?
Okay, so I think that the confusion has to do with the idea of being covered by the blood. Okay? Because we think of that from a Christian point of view now when you're asking those kind of questions, you know, being covered by the blood. We're not understanding what the blood does. Okay? The blood was in Egypt to have death pass over. Okay? Or to be covered by the Father so death would not enter that house. All right? So there was a protective element there. But it was from a death. And so while they were in the house covered by the blood, they were protected from the death. If they had stepped out of the house, they were no longer protected from the death during that evening, right? Okay, because anybody not in a house with the blood was killed, the firstborn only. By the way, it was only a death to the firstborn, so it didn't cover everybody anyway. Now, it was not anything beyond that. It was not the covenanting. It was not a relational thing. It was simply for that one plague. Now, because of the awesome devastation of Egypt by the plagues, many were impressed with the Elohim of Israel. And so many decided to leave. And by the way, they were not all people that had blood on their doorposts. Some of them may have lost loved ones, but still were impressed enough to say, I don't need to be here anymore. Plagues, death, everything else, I'm going to go with them. Because the covenanting doesn't happen until they get to Sinai. Now look, let's take Yeshua's blood the same way. I've given you the story about the path with the blood canopy over it as a metaphorical picture. And I've said the same exact thing to you. If you're on the path, which is halacha, right? Walking on the path, the derech, and you're walking that path. Okay, we call that halacha, a walking of the Torah. And you're now covered by the blood in the covenantal relationship. You are protected against the ultimate death. We're clear on that? However, if you step off the path, you are no longer covered. That's why we have a thing called teshuvah, repentance, and turning around and getting back on the path. So you return and you repent, and now you're covered again. But when you are off the path, it's like stepping outside the house during the 10th plague. You're not covered. Okay? So let's be careful that we are not understanding the blood thing. See, in Christian terms, covered by the blood means you confess, make an altar call, you're covered by the blood, you're once saved, always saved, it's all over, you're all good. You're good to go, no worries, no harm, and nothing, you're good. That is completely wrong. Listen to the teaching if you're new called Are You Saved? There's a lot of teaching you'll need to listen to, but just go through the CC 101 classes, okay, the Covenant Community 101. There's only 200-300 videos in there, but you'll work your way through it. Only because I never told Marty to stop calling them CC 101, so I didn't know where to stop. So next thing you know, he comes to me and says, by the way, we've got like 300 videos now under CC 101. I said, oh, I totally forgot to mention which ones. But they're all good to be in there, so it's not a problem. But recognize that you're still thinking through the mainstream of Christianity's understanding of the blood. The blood only applies to you if you stay in covenant, as far as it being a protector against the second death. The blood of the lamb protected them against a first death, and only the firstborns. Everybody else was fine. If you weren't a firstborn, you weren't at any risk. It was only the firstborns that were a threat. We're being threatened, which is why the Last Supper was more likely a last meal before the fast of the firstborn, which was a tradition that they did in Galilee and some other places, because after all, the firstborn are memorializing that they, if it weren't for what happened in the miracle with the Passover, could have died. And I take that seriously because I'm a firstborn. And so I understand that that applies to the firstborn. Okay? And there's a tradition you could do. It's not a commandment, but you could have a nice meal the night before Passover and fast until the Passover meal. You certainly could do that. But that would only be for the firstborns, not for everybody. And again, it's not a Torah command. And you could just as easily see that Yeshua and his disciples might have been doing that and say, well, then we need to do it. Well, certainly you could do it. Just like the foot washing certainly could do. Nowhere in Scripture does the foot washing become a commandment that he says, now teach everybody else to do it. He says, you need to wash each other's feet as I have washed your feet. Stay humble. Okay? And so that's important. All right, next question.
This comes from a gentleman who's out in Alaska, out in the bush somewhere. He wants to know, if I only throw out my yeast starter on my counter and old bread, am I being obedient? I'm in the bush out in Alaska. It's hard to get supplies as it's a fly-in situation only. Must I throw out my yeast too?
Okay, listen to Passover Q&A part one, but I'm going to answer your question also now. Okay, so for every year, I'm going to give you some instruction, and for this year, I'm going to give you instruction. So for every year, listen to part one, we're only getting rid of that which is what we call chametz. Chametz is stuff that's already made leavened. Breads, cookies, cakes, those kind of things, okay? Those that have already been made leavened. Now, then we have seor. That is the thing that leavens something, like the yeast or the starter lump for like sourdough bread, that kind of thing. Now, bear in mind that they did not have what we have today in manufacturing and production. We could have big jars of yeast and big containers full of yeast to make your bread with. They made bread, as it talks about in the scripture, by letting it either have the little starter lump in it and letting it sit and letting the yeast that's in the air come and leaven the bread. But they didn't have time to wait for it to happen and all that stuff. They had to make the bread in a hurry. Okay? So, if you have yeast, literally just yeast, like bags of it or boxes, you do not need to throw out your yeast. Okay? Just don't make any bread with it. You need to get rid of your chametz. You need to get rid of the stuff that's already leavened. Now, if you're out in the bush and you have trouble getting supplies and all these other things, and you have not planned well to not have an overabundance of things by the time you get to Passover, this is for this year, if you're a first-timer or if you're dealing with the COVID-19 lockdowns, if you overbought not thinking that Passover was coming because you were so afraid of just supplies in the stores, and you bought things that were bread products and crackers and whatever it is, that stuff, if it's sealed and not opened, lock it down, don't eat it during unleavened bread, save it for when it's over. Put it somewhere in the house where it's in a box, sealed, whatever, locked down. Just know that you're not going to eat it, okay? Now, if you have anything, of course it's already first day of unleavened bread, but if you have anything that would have been open or started, etc., then that would need to go. And we're not doing this to protect our cookies and our cakes. We're talking about things that would be more a part of being food. So you may have, for example, maybe you got frozen dinners and things that happen to be made with some leavening products because it had some bread in it, you know, like maybe like a pot pie or some other thing that might have a crust on it or something that had some bread products, whatever. Okay, so those things, you know, you would be able to lock it down and just not eat it during unleavened bread. Okay, but you want to plan in advance. As you're approaching a month or two before unleavened bread, start eating all your leavened products and stop buying new ones, so that you can have a house clean of those things for unleavened bread. It's a matter of planning your life. If you're new, you wouldn't have known to do this so much. But it's about planning your life, knowing things are coming. You have to know that unleavened bread is coming. My wife is excellent at taking all the leavened stuff out and cluttering the counters and tabletops with it, saying, this stuff that's in your way, it's in your way because you need to eat it. So now we know what needs to be eaten. It's there on the counter. Eat it. Then that's for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks before unleavened bread. It just gets pulled out. We need to eat this first. Now, of course, if it's still refrigerated or frozen, she reminds us, hey, we've got waffles and pancakes and whatever. You need to eat this stuff that's frozen. And you get it out of your house. And you stop buying it in advance. All right, hopefully that answered that question. But listen to the Passover Q&A. I get into more specifically there.
Okay, here's one that somebody's struggling with out there. What about Luke 22:13-15 in regards to Passover?
Okay, so that's not a problem. Again, listen to the teaching on the Passover Q&A. It's on part two, okay? He says, and he tells them, it starts off with, verse 7. And the day of unleavened bread came when the Passover had to be slaughtered. Well, see, already that's a mess, because if it was Passover, is before unleavened bread. But his saying is it was approaching. These things were approaching, and Kefa and Yochanan went, and they asked, "Go and he sent Kefa and Yochanan, saying, 'Go and prepare the Passover for us to eat.'" And they said, "Where do you wish us to prepare it?" And so he tells them where to go. So in other words, go get a place. Now listen in verse 11. He says, "Where is the guest room where I might eat the Passover with my taught ones?" And they showed him a large room, and he said, "We'll prepare it there." They had to get ready for this event. Okay, remember, they're going to have to go get this lamb, and they're going to have to go and cook it, and they're going to have a meal. So they had to get a place secured. Remember, they're traveling into town, and they're going to have a place to do the Passover. And this is an important, piece of this, is that they have... Oh, and by the way, I just thought of this. There's another problem with the Last Supper being a Passover, is because they had instructions at that time that they were never to leave the place that they ate the meal until the morning. And they went out right away after the meal. They ate the Last Supper, and they went to for a walk, and they went to the Gethsemane, and they did these other things, right? And all the stuff running them back and forth for the trial. Nobody would be doing these things on Passover night. They would have been having the meal, and everybody would have been home, and nobody would have gone anywhere. There's another good proof right there, because they were told in the Torah. Not the instruction in Exodus, but the later instruction in Leviticus, where they were told, "And you're going to keep the Passover and do it, and you're going to stay where you and stay there till morning." So you have that. Okay, so then it says here in verse 13, "And going, they found it as he had said to them, and they prepared for the Passover." So they're preparing for the Passover. They're not eating the Passover meal. Yeshua says, "With great desire I have desired, with great yearning I have desired to take this Passover with you." He didn't say, "Hey, I'm so glad I'm getting to have this with you." He said, "I've desired to keep this Passover with you," but he knew he was going to be dead before Passover, so he wouldn't be able to take it. So you got to remember, you're looking at English translated out of Greek, out of Hebrew. Hebrew to Greek to English is a bad thing. Look, in almost all of the Gospels, except for John, because John doesn't have the same problem, it says things like, on the first day of unleavened bread, they were asking him where they're going to go keep the Passover. So clearly the translators had some challenges understanding how to read the actual, Matthew 26:17, "And on the first of unleavened bread, the taught ones came to him and said, 'Where do you wish us to go and prepare the Passover?'" Okay, well, if it's the first of unleavened bread, they're a day late. Okay, so Luke has the same problem. Mark has the same problem also. Just you want to see that. Okay, so in Mark 14:12, "And on the first day of unleavened bread, when they were slaughtering the lamb," you don't slaughter the lamb on the first day, you slaughter it the day before, because you have to eat it that night, and then you get to the first day of unleavened bread. See, again, either the person translating or doing whatever editing they did here completely didn't understand Torah at all, or we've got other translation issues, because there clearly is some problems here. This is where I showed the King James only people, and they got so mad at me when they stormed out of my congregation in Knoxville 20 years ago. They were driving everybody insane in the congregation because I was using the Scriptures version, the 98 version, because it had just come out right before that, and they were all King James only, and they were really driving everybody dizzy, and they were unrelenting. They were just relentless with it. And I said, "Enough. Turn here. See this?" And I took him to Matthew. I took him to Mark. I took him to Luke. I said, "There, your book is not perfect." Okay? So just knock it off. All of your King Jameses say the exact same thing with the same exact problem. The book was perfect in its original. Nobody has one. Okay? Yes, we all believe in the inerrant word of the Elohim. We just don't have a copy of it. Okay? But anyway, and they got so mad at me, they stormed out. but everybody else did this. Yay! Okay, they were, sorry. There was, in the words of Monty Python, and there was much rejoicing. Okay. All right, so because they were driving everybody nuts. So for all of you King James only people, I'm sorry, but your book's not perfect. And depending on which version you have, I mean, you know, the 1611 or whatever it is, it's got the word Easter in Acts where it doesn't belong. Okay, the Greek says Pascha, which would be Passover. So that's bad enough to show you your King James isn't perfect. Anyway, but do you understand? So the person who asked that question, the problem in Luke is also in Mark, it's also in Matthew. Okay, and it's talking about some timing issues. Okay, so that's not enough evidence when it talks about whether they were going to eat at that moment or prepare for it. What's more clear, though, is in John, where they said they couldn't go into the palace or else they would be defiled and then couldn't eat the Passover. So clearly, they hadn't had it yet. Also, it's clear that they killed him at the same time that the lambs were slaughtered. Well, you don't slaughter the lambs 2 days in a row, 3 days in a row. They killed them on that day and they had the meal that night. And so this is the challenge, okay?
That's so good, so wonderful. I love it. All right, two more and we're done.
Yeah, for you, I've only had to say this 417 times in the last 20 years.
Well, then I'll learn to say it 417 times. But I love it.